Welcome to the FAIR Podcast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of the FAIR Podcast. John Durham Peters is one of America's leading thinkers in the subject of communications. He's been called a master wordsmith and a wonderful brain. His work has been called witty, irreverent, and intellectually daring. Peters also happens to be Mormon. Media technology, the sending and receiving of information, can be understood as a call to action in the world, and Peters discusses some of the ethical questions media can raise.
In the modern world, we live in a world of vastly increased awareness of global suffering without a concomitant or parallel growth in the means to help global suffering.
We talk about the role media has played thus far in the restoration of the church through print, radio, and television.
Christianity is a media-friendly religion. The sort of communication consciousness is very deep in Mormonism. I mean, the first act of the restoration is a theophany in 1820. You know, the next act, you would probably say, is an act of publishing. Publishing of the Book of Mormon. It's a media act to get the word out.
Peters also brings a unique perspective to the possibilities and problems of witnesses and witnessing.
Big, huge experiences sometimes leave us speechless. Sometimes the best witness is one which is stammering.
Peters joined me through Skype from his home in Iowa for this two-part episode on Mormonism and communication. We're here with John Durham Peters. He is currently the A. Craig Baird Professor in Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. And he has written several books, including Speaking Into the Air, A History of the Idea of Communication, and another book on free speech called Courting the Abyss. Thanks for taking the time to join us today, John.
My pleasure.
And we're going to cover quite a few different topics today, but I want to start out by letting you give us a little bit of background, where you grew up, your membership in the church, mission, education, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, I was born in Salt Lake City in 1958, the first child of Carolyn Widsoe Durham and John Milton Peters. My dad was in med school and graduated in 1960 and moved to Baltimore for his residency at Johns Hopkins. We only lived there for a year because he got drafted. We moved to Alexandria, Virginia for 2 years. Then he decided he wanted to become a professor and went to Harvard School of Public Health, got a master's and a doctor of science, and stayed there. Teaching until 1980. So that meant that I grew up, partly on the East Coast. Partly in Baltimore and Alexandria, but mostly in the Boston area.
You grew outside of the Mormon corridor then. You were...
Yeah. My mother used to say I grew up in the diaspora. So my parents kind of left the church. By the time we had moved to Brookline in 1966, our church attendance was rather erratic. And though I was baptized at age 8, I didn't really go to church very often. And it was as an act of teenage rebellion. That's what my mother says. I think it's a little too psychological. But I with the invitation of a nice bishop and good home teacher and lots of support, decided to come back to the church at age 14, and I've never regretted it. So went to BYU for 2 years before my mission. I ended up skipping a grade in Boston schools. Went on my mission to the Netherlands, Netherlands-Amsterdam mission. Got home, married Marcia Paulson Peters. We've been married 31 years and 3 days. We have 2 kids. Graduated from the University of Utah with a bachelor's in English, master's in communication. Went to Stanford for a PhD and been at Iowa ever since with lots of travel.
Cool.
So that's my best effort to try to put it in a nutshell.
We'll start out here by talking a little bit about the book that you wrote. I believe it's the first book that you wrote, Speaking Into the Air.
True.
A History of the Idea of Communication. Talk a little bit about Speaking Into the Air.
Speaking Into the Air, I'm still rather fond of it. Usually after you finish a book, you hate it. And I was quite nervous about it at first, but I think it came out. Books are quite like children. You don't have control over them. They just come out in their own style and in their own way. I think it's a more successful, happier book than the second book. I was lucky enough to get an NEH fellowship to support the writing of it. I think that the NEH, when they saw my proposal, they said, aha, we hate this ugly, gross word communication and all this popular culture stuff. Finally, someone who's going to straighten it out. Because they're a very conservative granting institution. I can't quite figure out why they decided to fund it. But without that largesse, it never would have been written.
And it's sort of a strange project because you go into a lot of ideas that I wouldn't have expected. You cover a lot of different theorists. You talk about things like spirit wrapping and aliens, cybernetics, and all sorts of strange things. How did you decide to include those sort of ideas?
Well, part of it is a sense of mischief. The field of communication studies, like lots of academic fields, tends to take itself a little bit too seriously. And I thought it'd be funner if we could show the kind of alien, uncanny horizons to our thinking about communication. Plus, I think that, academic work tends to often have a deficit of imagination. I mean, not always, but I meant for this to be as imaginative as possible so that we could kind of break open what studying communication could be.
You include a lot of information from the Bible as well. There's a whole chapter that compares Jesus to Socrates.
Jesus and Socrates, of course, are the two central moral figures in the history of the Western world. And I suppose starting off the book with a comparison of Socrates and Jesus shows that my 19th century soul, because basically most 19th century authors ended up discussing them from one point of view or another. So, I mean, Nietzsche did it from the point of view of a debunker. Nietzsche actually liked Jesus, he just didn't like Paul. J.S. Mill compared him, Soren Kierkegaard compared him, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, you name it, everybody's thinking about Jesus and Socrates. And so it's sort of a maybe mischievous, but also sort of a grand gesture on my part to say that problems of communication are not just things that came into being with, pigeons and telegraphs, but they are fundamental issues that are bound up in the ethical problems that human beings face and have been wrestling about, the sages have been wrestling about for a long time.
One of the things you point out in the comparison is you compared dissemination to dialogue, and your idea is that Socrates was more of an advocate of dialogue, one-to-one communication, whereas Jesus was more disseminating. Did Mormonism inform that view of Jesus at all, or was it more based on the synoptic gospel accounts?
Mormonism, of course, informs everything I write in one way or another in ways that it's hard for me to always identify. I'm not, this is sort of a previous point, is I'm not sure that when you look closely that Jesus represents a purely disseminative model, because after the parable of the sower, he offers the inside scoop to his disciples. So it's clear that he's willing to do sort of one-on-one clarification. But as I think I mentioned to Ethan Jorgensen in a conversation published in Dialogue, that the way that I kind of assured myself that all my very diligent labors in the Netherlands were not just wasted, were by the metaphor of dissemination, that I was casting seed that would someday bear fruit. I mean, I guess it's a good way to, cognitive dissonance for a young elder to keep themselves from going nuts about the constant indifference.
I'm familiar with that. I served in Wisconsin, not too successful of a mission in terms of conversions, but that's what we would talk about as well. It's interesting. Early 19th century missionaries would often fall back on the idea that we're warning them, we gave them their warning, and now we're moving on. In fact, I just read a book by Reed Nilsen at the Church History Department about the Japanese mission, and after they pulled out of Japan in 1924, that was kind of the way that they salved their consciences. They said, we warned them, now we're out. It's funny because like you, here later on, many decades later, we instead turned to the idea of sowing seeds for future generations. It's kind of the decline in millennialism, I think, may have something to do with that.
Oh, that's a great point, because also in the Netherlands, I would think about, you know, Parley Pratt, who would go into a town and preach and then leave and sometimes even dust his feet.
Yeah.
You know, one chance only. Whereas, you know, in this town I was in once, Amersfoort, which I believe at the time had four companionships, an industrial town of 120,000 people. I mean, these people had an opportunity at least every 6 months to tell us to take a hike.
That's awesome.
It wasn't the most efficient use of human labor, perhaps.
Right.
But
right, it did good for we would also say, well, it does good for us, you know. Sort of.
Yeah, it did. It certainly. I remember our visiting general authority came and told us at one point that the main purpose of tracting is to keep the elders humble.
That's true. Let's move on to specific events in church history as far as the use of media and kind of talk about. In your book, you talk about the rise of different media sources. One thing that was really interesting to me is when you talked about the advent of the phonograph and how this was sort of a new media that captured something that had before that time been fixed. I'm talking about sound.
Yeah.
It's almost could capture time, you talk about. Go ahead and give us some background there.
Well, I mean, one of the cool things about phonography... phonography, I always need to be careful how to say that, because that might sound like another word which we're taught to avoid, like the plague in
yes.
the church, is that you have the possibility of time axis manipulation. That is, so for the first time in the history of the world, you can actually speed up a time series event, play it backwards, you know, pitch shift it in music. You can do all, you know, Alvin and the Chipmunks. You can, you know, play music too fast or too slow, not only music. Prior to Edison's phonograph, every time a voice or sound came into being, it would vanish, and that was kind of definitional of sound. With the phonograph, it's possible to store sound. I mean, technically, you can't store sound because sound is pressure. You know, it's atmospheric vibration, but it's possible to trace it in such a way that you can reproduce it with more or less with varying degrees of accuracy. I mean, there's no such thing as a pure sonic replication, just because sound depends on the space that it's in, the architecture. And actually, while I'm on this point, one of the things that this is just a very recent thought and an LDS connection is with the building of the tabernacle, there's this kind of built-in thing in Mormon culture and Mormon intellectual life, an interest in acoustics. And to me, it's fascinating that Carl Irene and Vernon Knudsen, I guess you say, and of course, Harvey Fletcher, above all, some of the great acousticians, physicists of sound in the 20th century, were all Latter-day Saint. And the Irene Science Center at BYU, I don't even know if it's named that anymore or if it exists anymore, but when I was there, it's named after Carl Irene. I believe is the uncle maybe of Henry Irene Sr., the father of, the chemist father of our President Irene now. So there's this very interesting connection in Mormon culture with sound and acoustics. And, you know, it goes to the Doctrine and Covenants about where you cannot go, there you shall send. You know, and in 1830s, send means, you know, send missionaries. But, of course, that gets reinterpreted by people like Alvin Dyer later as meaning broadcast. And President Kimball's great address, what is it, 73, 74, when he talks about the missionary effort going by transistors into Eastern Europe. There's this long, fascinating history of Mormonism being fascinated by sound. And, you know, the latest version, of course, is the Conference Center, which is essentially a gigantic TV studio for the voice to go forth. My former student, Judd Case, wrote a really interesting piece on this. I don't know if you saw it on the... I think it's in the Journal of Media and Religion about the performance of Lirial, the Brazilian Latter-day Saint pop singer, in General Conference, and both what it means for voice and a recording and what it means for the internationalization of the church.
Yeah, so
it's a long answer, but... Yeah.
No, yeah, the church wanted to tap into media pretty early on. We're seeing early on that they're using newspapers. They're
absolutely.
Using what's available to them, pamphlets.
Absolutely.
And... Marshall McLuhan, he talked about the global village. I think this is back in the 60s, and he talked about how technology would help the global village kind of come together. And it's interesting because back in 1850, Orson Pratt, one of Mormonism's foremost authors and publishers, he almost exulted in the increasing ease and speed of travel. He said, "It's almost united our continents into one." And he said that technological developments would be like Isaiah's prophesied swift messengers. And he talked about how these new media and these new ability to travel will basically roll forth the kingdom of God sort of thing. I mean, he situated all of these advancements into the narrative of the restoration.
Yeah. Orson Pratt is a really fascinating thinker about communication, as is Parley, because, as you say, they're both publishers and preachers. And they really tap into something deep in the history of Christianity, which is Christianity is a media-friendly religion. If you look at Paul's letters, Peter Simonson has written a very nice piece about the notion of mass communication in Paul, which is now a chapter in his recently published book called Refiguring Mass Communication, which I think is really cool. But Christians have always been, you know, fascinated by, I mean, the gospel. What does the gospel mean? It means the good message. And so this sort of communication consciousness is very deep in Christianity in general. It's very deep in Mormonism. I mean, the first act of the Restoration, you can argue, is a revelation, a theophany, of course, in 1820. And the next act, you would probably say, is an act of publishing. You know, the publishing of the Book of Mormon. It's a medium. It's a media act to get the word out.
What are the implications of that? It's a book. It's like almost the first big thing Joseph Smith had to do was put words on a page.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, I shouldn't focus just on Christianity, they're all book religions, and they're all media religions. And they all have interestingly different philosophies of media. So in Judaism, there's a lot of interest. I mean, lots of people have written about the aniconic trend within Judaism. I mean the anti-figural, thou shalt make no graven images. So a kind of downer on the eyes and on visual art, which, you know, is reproduced in Islam to various degrees, although Islamic art is clearly figural. I mean, that there are lots of modes within Islamic art where you can see animals in geometric shapes and patterns. But so I don't know, maybe all the ethical monotheisms are media friendly in interestingly different kinds of ways. But they're also mediaphobic in interestingly different kinds of ways. I mean, the critique of idolatry, the golden calf, that's kind of like, you know, the fundamental act that all media critics like to do since. I mean, smashing your television set or, you know, torching your CDs. I mean, people still do this kind of stuff as a kind of, you know, resistance against the evil idols. So I don't know. I mean, the implications are really rich and wide.
So yeah, so the church was making use of media almost as soon as it was available to them, and you know, you have to reach a certain point in civilization, I guess, to even have a group to send books to. You know, there has to be literacy and things. It's kind of interesting with Mormonism, where we have this idea that God gave the gospel to Adam, and traditions of perhaps he writing a book of remembrance and things.
Yeah,
coming back around to the phonograph, 1898, it was the earliest recording of a church prophet that we've had, is Wilford Woodruff. His son brought in this machine and said, you know, this is a talking machine and I want you to talk into it. I'm going to play a little portion of that first recording here. It sounds pretty bad, but I'm going to play a little bit of this, and I want to go back to that idea of capturing time and also maybe talk about what he chose to emphasize here. So here it is. Okay, so he's talking about his testimony here, and he starts off by talking about Joseph Smith standing before a group of people and speaking, obviously live, and here's this prophet speaking into a recording box, and he's talking about the keys and the powers that God bestowed on Joseph Smith and sealed them upon the Quorum of the Twelve. It's sort of an interesting recording there. What what kind of sticks out to you about this? It's 1898.
Oh, man. It's very cool just for me to hear this little drop of, you know, it's like dinosaur DNA in amber. We can hear an early Latter-day Prophet's voice. I mean, to me, it's so interesting that we have no idea what Joseph Smith or Brigham Young sounded like, and that's a simple technological fact.
Or we know that Joseph Smith, even a photograph of Joseph as well, right? We don't even have a photo.
Exactly. Well, we have a daguerreotype, don't we?
It's of a painting.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, I've never followed out.
That's interesting, too. We have a daguerreotype of a painting of Joseph Smith.
Well, that's one of the points I was going to make about the Wilford Woodruff voice, is that the acoustic quality of it sounds like it's gone through multiple layers, just like, you know, what we know of Joseph's image has gone through multiple layers. And in some ways, our access to the past in general is always technologically mediated. And, I mean, the argument that I make in speaking into the air is that these layers of mediation should not be necessarily seen as obstacles, but should be embraced for the richness that they give. And just to hear Wilford Woodruff's voice, someone who's, you know, edited diary I read when I was a teenager and was very inspired by, I mean, it's pretty thrilling, because it's a kind of, you know, being in touch. I mean, we actually have access to the nonverbal, to what scholars call the paralanguage of Wilford Woodruff, which we don't have access to for Brigham Young or Joseph Smith, for instance.
Why is it?
It's the embodiment. I mean, we get something of the body of Wilford Woodruff. It's like having a lock of his hair.
That's what I was going to say, is why is it so interesting? Why is it?
Because it's authentic. Because, I mean, touch in some ways is understood as a more authentic sensation than sight, certainly. And that hearing always involves an element of tactility. It does mean, if you've ever been at a rock concert or been by a really loud noise, you know, you can feel sound, and that, you know, our eardrum is really an organ of touch or tactility. I mean, that's, you know, I know it's kind of metaphorical, but certainly, I mean, the eardrum is perturbed by sound waves, and that's how we hear. So there's, you know, fides ex auditu, I think Paul, or Jerome's translation of Paul says, faith comes by hearing. And, you know, Lee Eric Schmidt has this really cool book called, I'm forgetting what it's called, I think it's called Hearing Things, maybe, but which is about hearing and the religious imagination in America in the 18th and 19th century, just how important the voice is. And, you know, what I haven't read it in great detail, but I kept thinking, where are all your Mormon examples? Because, you know, he easily could have plugged in a bunch. I mean, again, the King Follett discourse with Joseph trying to outshout the wind, and, you know, the very mode of delivery becoming a kind of type of the very problem that he's talking about, mortality and immortality. I mean, how do we get from, you know, this earthly sphere where voices vanish to an eternal sphere in which everything is written? Everything is written in heaven, as he, you know, as Joseph writes in section 128.
That's really interesting. And in addition to this sort of romance of the sound, or this being courted by the sound, there's also been some pushback, too. And you talk about this in your book, the kind of a recurring reticence to use new media for the fact that there's something inauthentic about it. It happened with writing when I think Plato was saying, you know, oh, that we're writing this down, that's kind of ruining it. And the same sort of ideas came up with radio. In the church started using radio in about 1922. That's when President Grant delivered the first Mormon message over the air. And then conference was broadcast in 1933. What are some of the reactions on the other side of the aisle that people have had to advances in new media, where they've said there's something dangerous about this, or there's something that we don't like about this?
Yeah, let me come up with a more contemporary example. I think this tension is wonderfully captured by Elder Ballard and Elder Bednar in their two talks, in which Elder Ballard wants us to be aggressive even in embracing the potentials of new media for spreading the gospel. And I think Elder Bednar really has it's a magnificent analysis about the potential for, you know, reality and irreality in new media. I mean, the world of simulation, we build temples, the world of simulation, we wreck marriages. And I think that, you know, the way that Elder Bednar puts it really captures that ambivalence just beautifully. And I mean, there was the same ambivalence about radio, that it's fake. that it has a, people call in the 20s and 30s talked about psychological burglary. You know, these creepy voices coming into your house. And, you know, some radio genres exploited this, you know, like horror, you know, the shadow knows, you know, to use sound effects to kind of play up this, you know, the creepiness of this disembodied voice coming in into your household. And so, you know, for us, the disembodied voice can be the voice of God or the voice of the spirit or the voice of the prophet. But, you know, voices that, you know, don't have accountable origins, you know, the point about that Steve Connor's book, he just says that ventriloquism was long understood as satanic witchcraft or black arts. In other words, dangerous stuff to have a voice that, without a body. One way to, you know, to put it in academic speak is that new media always have dialectical responses. That is that they always inspire fears and hopes, and usually the fears and the hopes are about the same things. So the disembodiment of radio is something that's fabulous if it can be seen as a kind of spiritual enhancement. It can also be seen as something terrifying if it's a kind of suggestive nudge of satanic power.
Yeah, you talk about in the book, you talk about how radio quickly became an address to a very intimate audience. Broadcasting right. became very particular. Why is that?
Well, what's funny is that, you know, the style of address, which we think of as mass communication, was actually found in public settings, in congregational settings, so that where someone would stand up in front of the Bowery or the Tabernacle and talk to a bunch of people at once, you would evolve a very kind of declamatory, loud, shouty, impersonal style. But when you're talking to even to millions of people over the radio, that kind of style doesn't work because it makes them feel as if they're outside in a big crowd instead of sitting at home around the family circle. And so radio, to survive, had to evolve into modes of discourse that were chummy, sociable, chatty, conversational, and they had to simulate a kind of style as if the radio was sitting there in the living room, which indeed it was.
It's interesting to see how General Conference now, to move to television, I think the first televised General Conference was in 1949. And when you see General Conference, they're addressing, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Conference Center and all of you gathered throughout throughout the world. So it seems Mormonism is still trying to construct this this tight-knit community in General Conference, even though it's being broadcast.
Yeah, I think it succeeds in doing that because, you know, the cast of characters who speak to us are well known and beloved. The people who speak to us. So, I mean, well enough so that President Uchtdorf can get up and make a joke about everybody expecting him to talk about flying airplanes. You know, and it's very intimate, and I mean, I think it's really wonderful when, you know, we kind of expect him to talk about airplanes. When he talks about tree rings, people are caught off guard, and he's able to make an in-joke that, you know, that is very endearing.
You tied this sort of broadcast community to the idea of mass, to the idea of a sacrament.
Right. Well, I think part of it is from hanging out with Catholic friends who study media. And at one point, I wrote a silly short little essay about the three approaches to media studies. There's the Catholic approach, the Protestant approach, and the Jewish approach. I haven't figured out what the LDS approach would be. Maybe we don't have enough LDS media scholars to try to figure out if there's one approach. But the Catholic approach is interested in ritual, in institution. And, I mean, as a simple kind of jokey pun, that mass could also mean a noun, you know, the great celebration, the ceremony. And indeed, mass, the noun, comes from the Latin word mittere, to send. So, you know, the mass, the Catholic mass, is itself a kind of sending, a broadcast, missio, a mission. Mission means, you know, in German you say Sendung, or Sending, where I went on my mission in Holland. It means to be sent. And so there's all these really rich, you know, semantic meanings built into, you know, European languages, which suggests that sending and massness doesn't need to mean anonymity and, you know, loss of contact, but actually something very profound, very meaningful.
You've also talked about, kind of on the same subject, the ethical obligations that, that media can bring to a person. So we're going to kind of shift the subject over to the idea
sure.
of witnessing. What you've said in one of your books is that facts that we see perhaps in a news broadcast or elsewhere, impose moral and political obligations that fictions don't. And that if you see some sort of suffering, say like the earthquake in Haiti, it fixes an obligation on a person. Can you talk a little bit about the ethics of witnessing through media?
Yeah, big topic. Let me give an easy LDS example just because we're still on General Conference. I mean, two ways the General Conference allows us to step out of the role of mere spectator, passive spectator, is the sustaining of church officers, and also the way the priesthood meeting is done, the fact that it is not broadcast and you actually have to go to a meeting house. You have to have that sense of shoulder-to-shoulder camaraderie, the father-son thing. And, you know, for me, I've got two sons. It is a highlight of the year to be able to go to, you know, the priesthood broadcast and, you know, sit by a son or two, depending, you know, what part of the world that they happen to be in. Partly what I'm trying to do is figure out what the bound between fact and fiction is. And a fact is something that has witnesses. A fiction doesn't have witnesses. So there aren't any witnesses to Hamlet. I mean, there are lots of spectators of Hamlet or readers of Hamlet. I'm not saying that there aren't all kinds of truths in Shakespeare's play, but it has a kind of different connection to the real world because there was no one who witnessed Hamlet and Ophelia and Gertrude and Yorick and so on.
You might bump into a person who was murdered on stage after the show, sort of a thing, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. Great example. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a willing suspension of disbelief, which is true for fiction. Of course, willing suspension of disbelief is also something which we do in religion as well. So, obviously, I'm not trying to say that religion is only on the side of the factual. But when we talk about witnessing, which we do in religious context and in Mormon context, we're taking a mode of authentication and of nailing things down, which is usually understood to be in the factual realm, and using it for a realm in which, you know, the counterfactual or the invisible or the, you know, the felt is much more powerful than, you know, being an eyewitness or an ear witness, which is why I'm interested in the whole idea of being a body witness. I mean, that you actively witness just by putting your body in a certain place at a certain time.
So you're saying there is significance in say, sustaining the prophet when you're sitting perhaps at home on the couch. And also, you mentioned priesthood. That's interesting to me as well, how, you know, we have to go and shoulder-to-shoulder sort of a thing. You're saying, is there more kind of ritual power in being with others that way, or?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is an old joke. I once had a friend when I invited him to come to church that they said something like, well, I don't believe in organized religion. I said, perfect. we're not organized. Come on over. Silly joke. But, clearly there is something powerful about the genres and contexts of sociability that getting together in church has. I mean, without sacrament meeting, you don't have people put all this labor into preparing talks and then standing up and giving them. I mean, people just wouldn't talk that way without the institutional sustaining. People wouldn't do the kinds of things that they do. So there's a kind of intelligence, I would argue, built into the communal practices of religious worship that cannot be replicated through solo meditation. Not that solo meditation isn't great also, but for me, at least, I need the ritual aspect to sustain a full life of faith, I would say.
And back to the topic as well of, for example, the Haiti earthquake. We had broadcasts almost that, you know, within the hour. We had the church had trucks being sent out really quickly,
right.
And you had people sitting at home watching celebrities sing on TV or donating money and do these things. So it can all happen very quickly, but do you think that can also, that kind of increases that burden of obligation to a global community?
Yeah, it does, but it's complicated because, you know, if there's a flood in Iowa City, which there was 2.5 years ago, then I'm easily mobilized. I know what I can do. I can go sandbag. If there's an earthquake in Haiti, what I can do is complicated by the sheer fact of distance. And, you know, there's a really interesting book by this French sociology sociologist called Suffering at a Distance. And he suggests that essentially all we can do in a world of mediated suffering, televisual suffering, you know, photojournalistic suffering, is to donate or to speak out. And, you know, that seems a kind of meager menu of options. And certainly I'm glad that we, you know, that the church does humanitarian on the ground work. But, you know, I remember people, you know, saying in the Haiti quake, you know, stop all, you know, you do gooders, stop coming down here. You're mucking up the infrastructure. You know, we can't support all these people coming in who don't know what they're doing. And so, I don't know. I mean, it's in the world of television and of journalism more generally, and this goes back to the 19th century. In the modern world, we live in a world of vastly increased awareness of global suffering without a concomitant or parallel growth in the means to help global suffering. Obviously, we have the rise of philanthropy and of all kinds of really great humanitarian organizations. But, you know, in the end, suffering is intractable. You can't fix it. My mother-in-law recently died, I guess almost 3 weeks ago. And, you know, sometimes, you know, when you watch the Haiti thing, you see, if only I were there, I could do something. But sometimes you are there and you still can't do anything.
Right.
You know, besides, I guess President Irene talked about this in a conference about he wanted to see, you know, the master lesson in how you minister to a suffering. President Kimball comes in, talks to his dad, just hangs out, doesn't do anything. And I think sometimes admitting our impossibility to do anything except just be there is maybe the most profound testimony of care or of love that we can bear. So I'm a big believer in showing up. You just go to church. You know, you just do your home teaching, good stuff will happen.
It seems to me to be kind of your solution to the problem of communication itself as well, that there's this sort of gap between sender and receiver that if you really take the time to think about it, doesn't feel like we're really able to bridge in a perfect way. And
right.
So just kind of being there, is that tied into your idea of how communication works at all?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I like these slow pitches down the middle. It's excellent.
Okay.
Let's see. So, I mean, like in speaking into the air, I talk a lot about, you know, the anxieties that are aroused, as we just discussed, about disembodied media. And a lot of the people who are complaining about radio or the telephone make it sound as if it would all be fixed if we could only get there face to face. And the melancholy conclusion of speaking into the air is that, you know, even being there, you know, touch is no guarantee either. I mean, touch may be the best, but, you know, at some level it may be, you know, the guarantee of authenticity. But in the end, you can't guarantee sincerity or authenticity. I mean, there are no guarantees. That's why faith is so fundamental for all that we do.
Perhaps the thing that sticks out to me most is the guarantee of even meaning sometimes. When we hear somebody, how do we know that you know, that we're really getting what they're saying? You've mentioned the problem of the gap between a sender and receiver. You're not quite conscious of what the other person is really getting from you. And you've compared it to sensory experience, the taste of pineapple to the pains of childbirth. These experiences vanish when put into words and remain inaccessible to others, except in as much as they claim to share similar experiences. Sensation is encircled into privately personal ontologies. So, you put it really starkly, this kind of disconnect. It can almost make one feel lonely, even in the presence of other people.
Yeah, well, I mean, I often feel more lonely in the presence of other people than I do when I'm by myself. I think the loneliest I ever felt was at a stake youth dance when I was about 15, and just kind of walking around and feeling like no one wanted to dance and I didn't want to dance, and just this kind of weird kind of crowd, you know, a little bit of stupid teenage angst. I'm really glad I'm not a teenager anymore. But I mean, you can certainly feel lonely in crowds. You can feel in wonderful company reading your scriptures or reading Emerson or reading someone that you read, reading a letter. I do think that this is I guess you say I put it starkly, but there is something fundamental about the problem of bearing witness, is that the witness is always a downgrade in the quality of the knowledge, because the witness has a privileged access to some kind of truth, or else they wouldn't be a witness. But So, I mean, the listener to The Witness can never have the original experience that The Witness had. And it's all ultimately an act of faith, I would say. I mean, you just choose, you've got to make the leap and then see what works for you.
What stuck out to me with what you were saying was it reminded me of Joseph Smith as a boy. Lucy recalls him saying that he'd rather go out in the wilderness with the Bible than to join in communion with other people. But as Mormons now, we kind of emphasize going to church and being with other people. But that can intensify a feeling of alienation in certain cases, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I know people who come to church who feel put off or alienated. I mean, I know people who come to universities who, you know, feel put off and alienated. I mean, so, I mean, it isn't unique to the church. It's just a feature of how people fit in institutions. There are lots of different flavors, but you know, I think the church does emphasize, you know, scripture study and prayer. I mean, the Sunday school answer solution to everything is, you know, go to church, keep the commandments, and pray and study your scriptures. And we don't have a really developed spiritual practice or culture for talking about the richness of prayer or of study. I mean, if you compare us with the Jews in terms of scripture study, we haven't really figured out all the richness of it. If you compare us in prayer with, like, Tibetan Buddhists or something, we don't really have, you know, the same elaborateness of practices. And, I mean, I understand that there, the LDS view could be that those things are kind of in danger of going off the deep end. But I do think there's plenty in Mormon culture, at least, to encourage, you know, meditation and solitude and, you know, the dark night of the soul and, you know, courting the abyss. I mean, that abyss metaphor comes from Joseph's letter from Liberty Jail about how the mind of man is supposed to, you know, ascend into the darkest abyss. Yeah, so why not?
I want to get into that idea of courting the abyss, but before we do, you mentioned prayer, and there's a part in Speaking Into the Air where you're talking about, again, this problem of communication. You ask, where do projections of myself end, and where do authentic signals from the other begin? And you say, this can kind of be multiplied when it comes to prayer with God. How would you approach that when someone says, I'm trying to pray, I kind of feel like I'm just kind of talking?
I'd say outstanding. I mean, prayer is an exercise. It's like aerobics for the soul. And talking to someone else isn't always a matter of transmitting information or of receiving some answer from it. It can just be chatting. And I think that if we think of prayer as play or as exercise or as work or as praise or as music, it's much better to think of it that way rather than the kind of spiritual telegraphy, this utilitarian message sending thing. The Lord speaks through our minds and through our in ways that we're likely to understand, and so He'll speak in our language. And I think we're co-creators of answers to prayer. And I don't think that's heretical. I think that's how it works.
Before we leave witnessing, there's one more thing I wanted to bring up, and that's Joseph Smith's witness of the first vision. And anyone who has read the multiple accounts will see some differences in those accounts. In a chapter you wrote about witnessing, you say that the sort of curious thing about witnessing is how retroactive it is. And there's even some problems of quality there. What are some of the problems with witnessing that you've talked about?
Well, witnessing is prone to all kinds of errors in identification and accuracy. We know this from social psychological studies, for example, of identification of faces, you know, in terms of like bank robberies, that, you know, people just make all kinds of mistakes in terms of identifying people. There's all kinds of examples of where, like, of traumatized people where lawyers can basically, you know, produce a memory that might not have been there. And so, I mean, there's a fragility and unreliability of witnessing, which has been recognized from the very beginning. And some of the ancient Greeks thought that torture was the best way to get an authentic witness from a slave, because the pain would keep them from lying. You know, it just kind of lashed them into speaking the truth and nothing but the truth. But as we know, torture doesn't really produce better information. I mean, I think torture is hideous. Little political note there. Where are we going?
Well, yeah, we're talking about that idea of witnessing. So with Joseph Smith, and here I'm going to read an excerpt. This, see, here's Now, no low balls right here. What I'm going to do is, I assume you're familiar with the regular account that we hear, the canonized Pearl of Great Price account.
Sure.
Here's the first written account. It's interesting. Frederick G. Williams is writing this history of the church with Joseph Smith in 1832. Joseph is obviously with him because at a certain point in the narrative, Joseph takes the pen. And it's just about the point where he talks about the first vision. And this is interesting, so I'm going to read this excerpt from the earliest known written account of the first vision. He says, this is Joseph, "Therefore I cried unto the Lord for mercy, and there was none else to whom I could go and to obtain mercy. And the Lord heard my cry in the wilderness, and while in the attitude of calling upon the Lord in the 16th year of my age, a pillar of fire is crossed out, a pillar of light above the brightness of the sun at noonday, come down from above and rested upon me. And I was filled with the Spirit of God, and the Lord opened the heavens upon me. And I saw the Lord, and he spake unto me, saying, Joseph, my son, thy sins are forgiven thee. Go thy way, walk in my statutes, and keep my commandments. Behold, I am the Lord of glory. I was crucified for the world, that all those who believe on my name may have eternal life." And then he goes on to say, "The world lieth in sin. There's none that doeth good." In the canonized account, he almost goes right to that apostasy narrative. So there's kind of there's a difference in how he relates that. How do you reckon with that?
Well, there's a difference in how old he was too, right?
Right. Yeah. The Pearl of Great Price account, I believe, is 1838. So it's been 6 years.
Yeah, but I mean, doesn't he say there the 16th year of his?
Yes, yeah, 16th year of his age, as opposed to when he was 14. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is it surprising that human beings narrate different events, the same event in different contexts to different people? I mean, can you step in the same river twice? The whole joke about that old saying is not only that the river changes, but you change. Can you step in the same river twice? Joseph wasn't the same person he was in 1838. We believe in ongoing revelation. Why couldn't Joseph's understanding of the Godhead have advanced? To me, it just seems like we trap ourselves in kinds of dumb ideas about how history and narrative work if we insist on a kind of narrow-minded view of authenticity. Sorry about the phone there. Communication abundance. I'm going to ignore it. The essence of a medium is revealed in breakdown. This is what Martin Heidegger says about, you know, the essence of any technology is revealed in breakdown.
Right.
So we can be grateful for all the contraptions that fail on us.
It's interesting with witnessing in this first vision account. You talked about how at the time a person doesn't really know they're witnessing something. They don't consider themselves in the moment as, well, perhaps not always, but when they're witnessing something, they're not thinking, you know, how am I going to explain this in my written account in 10 years?
Yeah,
you said in witnessing we look backwards on events we didn't realize we were observing. We're restoring deleted files from memory. So with Joseph Smith, he didn't know at the time that he was, I assume it was a very personal experience for him.
Sure.
And it seems the earlier account reflects that more than the later account does.
Right, yeah, because the earlier account seems much more about his spiritual standing rather than about him as the future founder of the Restoration or of the church. I like the line from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, "We had the experience, but we missed the meaning." And there's so many things that I've had in my life that I'm still figuring out. I mean, part of what, you know, the whole principle of psychoanalysis, whatever you think about it, is that you have events in childhood which stamp you for life and which you will, if you're lucky, figure out when you're a grown-up, or at least you'll figure out how to cope with them. And I'm not endorsing psychoanalysis, but I mean, what you have common to psychoanalysis and the argument that I'm making is an idea that big, huge experiences sometimes leave us speechless. Sometimes the best witness is one which is stammering or fumbling. We all know this from Mormon testimony meeting, that often we feel the Spirit most strongly, not when the word is most slickly delivered, but when someone's fumbling and breathy and, you know, weepy and, you know, it's not coming through. We know this through people who are traumatized. I mean, witnesses of the Holocaust often don't witness it. Our World War II vets, you know, you probably have friends too, I mean, or relatives who lived through World War II. They don't talk about it. And that silent witness is perhaps the most eloquent witness. So witnessing is fallible, but I mean, like all the other modes of historical apprehension, I guess that's a good pun, sorry, in the sense of fear and of grasping, but of historical knowledge, we know history through witnesses, but it means it's fallible, and ultimately you're going to get a kind of multi-perspectival, multicolored picture of the past. And we Latter-day Saints are sort of unique in, or not unique, but we have a kind of dangerous or interesting point of view in making articles of faith depend upon history. And I think sometimes we trip ourselves with you know, unsophisticated or unhelpful understandings of what history is or how it works, because it's messy. History's messy. As you know, if we were at the crucifixion, we would see the torchlight red on sweaty faces. We might not see the great event, which we can remember when we partake of the sacrament. Sometimes, you know, I think it's interesting that we bear witness when we take the sacrament to an event that we didn't witness. We remember something which we only have read about, but I think a lot of people would understand that that kind of witness is a more powerful one than if you were just a historical observer at Christ's Passion, because there are lots of historical observers there for whom it meant nothing whatsoever, and you know, Pilate or you know, the soldiers who just went on and with their lives and did nothing with it. Whereas, you know, we who weren't there, it can be something very transformative. And so why should, you know, the historical authenticity be the determiner of our spiritual life? I mean, that just seems to put our eggs in the wrong basket to me.
So why does my gut tell me that it's not that way? That, boy, it would be so great to have been there, even if I just saw the torchlights, you know. I think your point's well made, but there's still a gut feeling that kind of runs against that. Why do you think that is?
Because you live in a world of movies and of texts and of historical novels. I mean, we've grown up. I mean, modern life is a world of, we understand history as time travel. I mean, that history is a kind of, you know, you call up your travel agency and you go on this little trip to the past. And we do this through movies, through novels, like I say. And there's this kind of urge and itch and appetite to think that we could really be there. And, you know, in fact, if we were there in Jerusalem during the crucifixion, we might have gotten stuck in traffic. You know, I'm not trying
foot
to be
traffic, right.
Ironic, but I mean, there might not have been a hotel, or you might have gotten robbed on the way in, or, you know, Monty Python, for all their, you know, blasphemous, you know, irreverence, you know, when they talk about the Sermon on the Mount, you know, they kind of point out Jesus didn't have a microphone, you know, and so someone listening in the distance says, blessed are the cheesemakers, you know, and there's this little gag in the life of Brian about, you know, mishearing Jesus, you know, so that being at the Sermon on the Mount might have actually been, you know, a less high quality experience than having it nicely edited and distilled.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Fair Podcast with John Durham Peters. He'll join us again in the next episode to talk about his book, Courting the Abyss, on free speech in America. John discusses John Milton and truth grappling with error, Paul on not offending one's neighbor, civility in political discourse, the recent mosque controversy in New York, John's work on the atonement, and we'll talk about why he places mercy at the heart of his theory of communication. Questions and comments can be emailed to podcast@fairlds.org or join us for conversation on the blog at fairblog.org.